brief survey of a couple of things that are going on in the United States, some of which concern my activities at Caltech, some are broader than that. I will then be talking about the high-performance storage system, a particular archival storage system that we use, and then go on to some examples of how we're using it at Caltech. One of the developments in the very recent few days has been that the National Science Foundation has made awards for what you might think of as a replacement for the Supercomputer Centers program. So I'll say a few words about that program. NSF has been trying to connect more universities in the United States to the internet. I think enough was said about that earlier by David Williams, so I will skip over that. I'll say a few words about a program called the Accelerated Strategic Computing Initiatives, again from the data-centric point of view of what some of their needs. And if time allows at the very end, I might say something about work that I've been involved in related to petaflops computing. There again, if I have time, I would talk about the data aspects. So how do you feed a petaflops computer? So the, let me start just for tactical reasons with the ASCII program. The thing to look at here, I think, is primarily the title of the slide. Data generation engines are growing exponentially. So this slide talks about ASCII's perceived needs for computing speed, you know, by the end of this year, 100x what it had a couple of years ago, then 1,000 times, 10,000 times, and so on, by the early part of the next decade, 10 to the 14 flops. But the title is that these are data generation engines. So although it's simulation, primarily here, we have to worry a lot about how much data is involved. So some of the estimates of the ASCII program are, in terms of orders of magnitude of what they will need at a given year, is say that in the year 2001, where perhaps the computing engine might be 20 teraflops, you might need 10 to the fifth terabytes of tape, 10 to the third of disk, terabytes, remember, as the unit of measure here. So by the year 2007, you might need 10 to the seventh terabytes. And this is all then detailed in terms of memory size and so on. So the ASCII program believes that it has very substantial data needs. In fact, one of their early, perhaps the first university grant that was given by the DOE ASCII program was to my group at Caltech for one specific thing, our work on scalable input-output software. So that's clearly a high priority for them. In another ASCII slide, where they talk about the hardware requirements, you don't need to read the words. The key thing is that anything that's colored yellow is labeled a primary investment priority. And so down here under archive, disk and tape archives, you can see that they feel that ASCII has to invest in this because the trend, these downward red arrows, is that industry is getting worse at meeting the requirements, whereas in the green arrows, things like cache and raw computing, it's getting better. So we have to worry about the hardware requirements and certainly how do you manage the archives. So the NSF program will, the new one is called PACI, Partnerships for Advanced Computational Infrastructure, and it will get started in October of this year. Infrastructure is defined here very generally. It's not just hardware by any means, as I will explain. I think the key thing to focus on for PACI is the vision that was spelled out in the solicitation almost 2 years ago, which is that we have now scalable parallel systems, high-performance networking and high bandwidth. Well, of course, we don't really have that, but one has high hopes for it, and it's much higher than it was, and large capacity mass storage systems. So if you take all three of those, it creates the opportunity for a national infrastructure consisting of a number of geographically distributed sites, strongly coupled to high-end computational resources and data resources, and to each other. So the National Science Foundation is trying to create an environment which is similar to what you already live in yourselves because you're already groups that are working in a geographically distributed way. And so NSF wanted a leading edge site to have a lot of computing, you know, 1 to 2 orders of magnitude more capable computing and resources, including storage, than would be typically available. In other words, if one is going to have a center, it had better be a lot bigger than the machines that you already have, else why have a center? But then a lot of other institutions are going to be making up a partnership. And so 10 days or so ago, two winning teams were announced, one headed by NCSA at Illinois and one headed by the University of California at San Diego. And I'm involved in both of those to some extent, but quite heavily in the one centered around San Diego. I am the chief architect of that effort. And Caltech is a major partner in that. So the that particular partnership is called NPACI, not a very original name, but we couldn't come up with a better one, so it's the National Partnership, et cetera. The key features are we're application-driven for developing the infrastructure. And so we decided to select 3 technology areas and 4 application areas. The technology areas are adaptable, scalable tools and environments, data-intensive computing, and interaction environments. Included in the first one would be meta-computing software. So you can see there's a very heavy orientation towards a network-based computing, and we singled out data-intensive computing. Now, that does not mean that we will stop worrying about high-end computing. The San Diego system will, San Diego will install a system with about a teraflops of peak speed in a couple of years, but we believe that data-intensive computing is important. The names in parentheses are the leaders of these particular sub-areas. But we didn't want to develop that technology in a vacuum, and so there are 4 application areas: molecular science, which would include chemistry and biology, neuroscience, earth system science, which involves things like environmental studies and global climate modeling, for example, and engineering. So you take those and have them work together. Just to give you an example of what we will be doing in the data support environment, you know, we think that one has to worry about all the way from interaction environments at the top to data manipulation services, going down to databases, moving the data around, and then archival storage, file systems, and databases. Those are the general categories. And in our case, our first set of areas that we will be looking at include, you know, web proxies, data analysis tools, 4 of the digital library efforts that are already underway, databases for astronomy, brain image, molecular, and environment. So we have real databases that people care about. Moving data in parallel quickly in and out of the systems. So the scalable I/O work that I do is also involved here. And high-performance storage system that I will be talking about is the archival file system. We envision having approximately 10 of our sites with substantial data storage capacities, with the largest being at San Diego with a petabyte in a couple of years. And so you take those 3 technology areas and the 4 application areas, and we will have some specific projects, because I want to demonstrate that things really work. So for example, data-intensive computing and neuroscience, that there will be a project in brain databases. Turns out that instruments are pretty good at measuring brains in 3 dimensions as well, and so in a couple of years, a brain will be a couple of terabytes. So if you want a few hundred brains and compare their morphology, you will be moving a lot of data around and be doing, in some cases, a lot of computing as well. You can think of obvious examples in global climate modeling, where you have environmental databases, real-time sensor data, as well as models interacting in real time. So that gives you some idea of, you know, a major set of activities. The Illinois team will have similar ones that I think will be helping push technology in a way that perhaps will also be of interest to you. Before I talk about HPSS, let me just say a word or two about our current environment at Caltech, because it is one of the reasons that I was interested in getting a system like HPSS. We have a number of large parallel computers, some old ones like the Delta with 512 processors, the Paragon with 512 processors as well, but they have a fair amount of memory and they do generate a lot of data. A little further up the road, but still connected and part of our environment, is a Cray T3D at JPL, which is part of Caltech, and that's also a data generator, small IBM. And we're starting to install Convex SPP 2000 from Hewlett-Packard. We have in-house today, I think, 64 processors. I haven't been home in a couple of weeks, but by next week it'll be 128. And actually, turns out it'll be 256 processors by May of 97. So we expect this to be a big data engine. And then there's the archival file system that I will say a little bit more about. We also have had for several years two tape drives at 50 megabytes a second, and we have been wanting to include those as part of our archival storage. We had Unitree as our archival file system, and it turned out to be a daunting task to provide support for that, for those tape drives with that system, so we did not do that. So let me transition to a different technology for the next few slides. And I will turn this off. So the reason that people care about very large mass storage systems, you know, or for the kinds of applications that I've just hinted at so far, machines are getting a lot bigger, and unfortunately peripherals and storage devices are not getting correspondingly bigger or faster. Also, people have such large collections of data that you want to be able to get at them with a fairly high-level paradigm instead of having to worry about exactly which file name is on exactly what tape. You can do it that way, but the scale is such that it gets out of hand very quickly. And so, and then networking, as it gets better, will cause us to want to move more data around and store more data. So in this diagram, there are rough estimates of what you might need, you know, in the year 1998, 100 terabytes of storage, and this is just for a little facility like mine, and integrating the data with data management systems, and with local and national access. Pretty soon, a petabyte of storage, all of that is fairly likely. The way those estimates are derived are by looking at, in this case, simulations, things like 3D hydrodynamics. Today, for one problem run, you might generate a couple of gigabytes per hour, and so a complete run would be, say, 100 gigabytes. And we see this type of thing even at Caltech. GlobalOcean might be more, 250, numerical tokamak, 550 gigabytes in a typical run. So tomorrow, meaning in a year or two, then we get into terabytes for storing the results of an individual run. And those are, I think, fairly accurate estimates. So one way to try to handle more data storage, of course, is to go to network-connected storage, because you have a number of client machines, so this resembles vaguely my network, resource diagram, rather. So I had the Delta and the Paragon and the Convex, so there are a bunch of machines that generate or need data connected to some kind of a network, and then servers with different storage. In the IEEE mass storage reference model, you separate data and control, and you can do third-party transfers so that you don't have the servers getting in the way necessarily of the data movement. The key things that I was looking for in the archival storage system were openness. I mentioned the problems that we had with Unitree in supporting new devices, and parallelism. Individual devices are just not getting fast enough, so we need to use multiple ones in parallel. And I need to be able to support new data storage devices. We don't get too many new ones in this area, but some do come along every so often. So HPSS, fortunately, did have a focus on scalability, the ability to add new hardware, to do things in parallel, servers designed for doing concurrent transfers from various sources and sinks, and distributed servers, and a credible path to petabyte storage. So that was the thing that attracted me to it. Here's a little bit of detail on how the system is designed. So the green part is what is defined in the IEEE mass storage reference model. Even if you can't read these words here, this is bit file servers, for example, one key thing is that you can have multiple ones of each. So all of the components, pretty much, can be done in parallel or have multiple ones. Name servers, location servers, migration, purging services, repacking of the data. And clients can be, you know, things like just FTP, NFS, but also in release 4, which will be available at the end of this year for HBSS. DFS, for example, will be supported in virtual file system. So the software architecture then is to have, you know, clients, bit file servers, storage servers, and then physical volume libraries, physical volume repositories with movers. Let's see, at the top are just general things that you need, like communication security, transaction managers, logging of data about transactions, 64-bit math libraries. You want to have very large files and very large numbers of files, so you need all those kinds of things. So that's a high-level diagram of what you get. Like this says it in words, essentially, you have modularity. It's intended to be portable. One of the things that we will be doing at Caltech this spring and summer is, in fact, porting the client server to the HP Convex SPP 2000. But it has been ported to a number of systems, for example, the Mako CS2 at Livermore. I mentioned that it supports a parallel storage system application program interface. I'll try to give an example of that, of some work done at Caltech towards the end. And you know, there's provision for security and GUI-based management. I also have some examples of that. It works reasonably well. I don't have any experience at all on the security features as such, but for reliability, things like metadata mirroring that's done works well. Disks do fail. It's amazing, in fact, how many failures one gets with large numbers of disks, as you all know. And so just having the metadata automatically mirrored is quite essential. I will show you some examples of different storage classes that one can set up that also address reliability pretty nicely. Well, for example, if one has more than one tape robot, as say Cornell does, Cornell is one of the sites, one can not only specify that every time something goes to tape, two copies are made, but that those two copies reside in two different robots. And so you just define a storage class to do that, and it happens every time the migration takes place. Now, of course, both storage robots could go up in flames, I suppose, but it does reduce the probability of losing data that way. So that just going back to that, I'll skip it. HBSS is a piece of software that's been developed in collaboration with a number of sites. I'll give a partial list in a moment. And there's an executive committee that manages the development, helped by a technical committee. And then for essentially all the boxes on the previous slide, you have groups of people worrying about bit file servers, APIs, storage servers, and so on. There are frequent telephone conference calls and meetings and so on. There's an HBSS users meeting coming up, in fact, at Oak Ridge in a couple of months, I think. Some of the sites that are on that are using HBSS and also developing are Caltech, Cornell, Fermilab. There's a talk on its experience with HBSS coming up this week. IBM, Livermore, Los Alamos, and Sandia. Those are the three ASCII laboratories. I mentioned the DOE ASCII program. Those are the three main laboratories, and they have all chosen HBSS. A couple of NASA sites, in addition to JPL, which is part of Caltech, the Maui Computing Center, which is run by University of New Mexico, University of Washington, Oak Ridge, and this is not a complete list. UC San Diego, for example, is a major user as well. So the kind of hardware environment then that's intended to run HBSS is you have a high-speed network which typically today is still HIPPY because typically that is still the high-speed network that's available in computing centers, but it can be fiber channel, ATM. You have servers, which are typically RS6000 or IBM workstations, and then you have clients, which could be big parallel systems, workstation clusters or whatever, or sequential systems. RAID disk farms, parallel tape farms with robotics or without, and then control through, and then interface through NFS, FTP, DFS, parallel FTP, and so on. In some cases, you can go directly from storage through the network to some visualization engine or just a dump frame buffer, and so you can stream data from your archive all the way through to wherever you do your visualization. And the idea is to be able to go gigabytes per second, which you would need to do for a lot of visualization. Petabytes is mentioned, so how credible is a petabyte system? Well, if you have, say, each of these purple boxes, eight of the IBM 3495 robots with their DLTs, and they're 140 terabytes each, so that gives you a petabyte. So this diagram here, you know, with a 32 by 32 HIPPY switch, a disk cache of about a terabyte of Maxstrat parallel disks, is something that you could buy today. Now you'd need a fairly large room and a deeper pocket than I have, that is more money than I currently have, but it's a credible configuration. That is, it would fit in a room smaller than this one, and it would work. You know, it doesn't require thousands of devices. It's just a, you know, relatively feasible kind of configuration. I suspect that there are places that have stuff like this already. In any case, I just put it up to indicate what you could do even today if you just had a little bit of money. Now, if we go to something a little bit more modest, namely my current HBSS configuration. So yes, I have this is the only thing that's in common. I do have a 32 by 32 HIPPY switch, but I don't have the rest of it. So we run our HBSS on two RS6000s. They're each fairly big. They have half a gigabyte of memory and 72 gigabytes of SSA disk each. They each have a HIPPY interface. And I have a 3494 tape library with just four of the tape drives. They're about 9 megabytes a second. Mounted on, connected to SCSI 2, which, you know, has a limit of about 20 megabytes a second. Well, the machines are, of course, the HP Exemplar, the Paragon, the SP2, and others. And then the two data tape drives are connected. They're also HIPPY connected. Now, they're not yet operational under HPSS, but that's coming pretty far along. They may be by the end of this month. HPSS is our archival file system now at Caltech. We turned off Unitree last November, I think it was. It's still not a lot of data that we have, but we have 62,000 files, 1,300 directories, 1.8 terabytes worth of files stored. But notice that it's 2.4 physical bytes used, and that's because some of the files are automatically given double copies when they're made, and that's why although the files only represent 1.8 terabytes of data, there's more than that stored. We only have 126 gigabytes of disk and HPSS and about 3 terabytes total stored right now. Now, this is for the large files only. We use, you know, different small, you know, tape stackers and robots for migrating and storing the small files that people have on workstations, by the way. One of the things that HPSS can allow you to do is to stripe across devices, either tape or disk, and it does it in an obvious way. So you can define a virtual volume, and of course a physical volume would be like this, and you're all familiar with striping, I'm sure. We do use striping at Caltech, although it's only two-way striping that we normally use because I only have 4 tape drives, and so if one of them were to break, then I would have a problem. But the performance is pretty good. So if one way on a read to tape is 7.5 megabytes a second, a two-way, in this case, happened to be more than that, it's just a quirk in our configuration. So, and then four-way, you don't see as much of a gain, but it's still faster. And then lower speeds, but comparable for one and two-way writing. At four-way, we were hitting another limit. So at least it does work, and you get enough of a speed up with two that it helps. You can do lots of fairly fancy things in going. I think something is out of order here. Well, that's okay, I'll talk about it here. You can have things that are segmented in different stripes, if you will, and then going through what's called a logical window, you can then put onto storage the data organized in a different way. So this is source and sink. So if you have striping here, just two-way striping, you can, on disk, say, you can go to three-way striping, XYZ, XYZ, onto tape, and vice versa. So you're not limited to keeping the same striping factor, for example. Parallel copies, you know, if they're client parallel copy going to mover attached storage. So if your storage is all controlled by a workstation or some kind of a computer, you know, from the client, if you have multiple processes going on, you can issue requests for data that's stored in parallel here. You get the attributes, the built file server tells the storage server to start the transfers, and then through, say, the HIPPY switch, you can have several transfers going on simultaneously. If you have network-attached storage directly, then it's essentially the same thing, except now the mover just tells this device to start firing the right data and giving it to whoever's requesting it. Yeah, this is a slide that I thought I had earlier. Notice that you can have data, say, on multiple disks. You can have four parallel transfers going on and ending up on just three tapes. In other words, the number of devices on one side does not need to equal the number of devices on the other. Now, that's useful not only if you want to play special optimization games, but it's also useful for reliability in case you lose one of your tape drives for a while. You don't have to reconfigure everything in a very elaborate way, as is the case in many other archival file systems. And I'll skip that. Now, to run HPSS, which is a large software system, you currently need DCE and Encina and SAMI. So these are separate products that you have to have running on your server to be able to use it. Fortunately, most workstations these days do support DCE. I don't know how long that will continue, but right now, that's something you have to do. With release 4, I believe, DCE will not be required. That is, it'll be an option of using HPSS without it. Okay, that ends that part of my presentation. Let me go to, then, quickly some examples of things that we're doing at Caltech to use the system, doing or about to do. Now, as I recall, this thing will need to be warmed up for a moment or so. One of the things that I mentioned just briefly a few minutes ago is that people want to be able to get at massive amounts of data without having to know all the details of where it's stored. Well, database systems, of course, are one way that people do that. And so it's important to be able to integrate database management and storage. HPSS does give one the opportunity to do that, although I didn't elaborate on it. There is a data management application programmer interface. So you can have a user application that may include calls to a database library and an HPSS library, and then have queries either going directly through the database management system or through HPSS to the final archive. At Caltech, we have a couple of projects, one of which is operational and several that are starting, in which we're using this. San Diego also has a couple of projects like that. So Roy Williams drew this picture and conceived of this particular architecture. The cartoon says that you have a user at a workstation with a graphical user interface, and typically there is some Java applet involved. I'll try to give a small example of that. But in any case, you can just think of a user using a normal workstation and connecting to a system that's producing or needing data. And the user code can be then making calls to HPSS either directly to read data or through a database management system. Perhaps process the data either by rendering or doing computing on it, and then sending it back either just to the standard workstation, or if you happen to have a big frame buffer or a video wall, a power wall, you could go directly to that. There are four projects that are considering or using this system. One is a synthetic aperture radar atlas. That's operational now, and you can use it on the web. I'll try to show an example of that. The LIGO project, for which there's a poster session at this conference, is considering an architecture like this. The Genesis project, which is in neurobiology at Caltech, is moving to it. And then the digital sky survey that I will describe now will be using this type of an interface. So the digital sky survey is one of my favorite applications. Tom Prince at Caltech really conceived it, and it's part of this NSF partnership that I mentioned we just were selected to do. So the idea is to create the digital sky, high-resolution digital reconstruction of the sky in multiple wavelengths and with an integrated catalog and image database. Our idea here is to make it available to the entire astronomical community, so that's a few thousand people, and to give them a new tool. So how big is the digital sky? Well, it's something like 4 terabytes for wavelengths, so multi-wavelengths, it's a few tens of terabytes. And we can do that now because a few terabytes is certainly easy to do with the software and storage that we have. We'll start with three existing databases. One is the infrared two-mass survey. And so that's about, there's a catalog of 100 million sources and 10 terabytes of image data now. The digital polymer survey is the optical northern sky, and that's a catalog of 2 billion sources with 3 terabytes worth of images. So these are enough data items that it would be nice to have a database system to help keep track of them. And then the NRAO VLA sky survey, which is 2 million sources, and again a few terabytes. So what we envision is that people will be able to do observation instead of by using the actual telescope, but initially by using the data stored on HPSS, accessed through a database management system, to view something. So for example, if a new X-ray source is discovered, you might first take a look at the part of the sky where it was discovered to see if you can spot what might be causing it. So that would be just moving data easily, finding it easily, and moving it so that you can look at it. Another example would also involve a lot of computation. So if you want to look at morphology of galaxies, to look for unusual ratio of infrared to optical flux, then you want to be able to get a lot of data from different parts of the survey and then do a lot of computing on it. So that, again, may resemble some of your applications. So we see that we need a compute engine, about 15 terabytes of storage, and being able to do image analysis on it. And we plan to use an object relational database. Have not selected it yet, although Objectivity is one of the ones that we're considering at this point. So that's not operational yet, but I hope that we will be able to get that up reasonably soon. because I think it will be a good demonstration of what you can do when you combine a lot of data, an easy way to get at data, a flexible way to store data, and then some compute power. The synthetic aperture radar application is operational, call that Sarah, and its architecture is similar to the other cartoon that I showed, as you might expect. So user interface can be HTML browser or other common things. Going to a server, which then gets that metadata for the synthetic aperture radar data, goes to a data server and either does computation or if it's already processed, then just sends it back to the user. So you have the familiar then GUI that starts out with an image of the world, and then you can click on a continent and get more detail on the continent. Where there are data, you see these little color splotches, and then you can click on, say, that splotch there, and you get some little thumbnail, which is low resolution, so you get it very quickly, and then you can choose which bands, which channels of data to depict in which colors by clicking on this, and how big an image to get, and also which data server to return the image from, because we have data stored in Italy and in San Diego and at Caltech. Well, Italy, regrettably, we don't use very often just because of the network problem. And then if you click on that, then you would get the full resolution multispectral image. So that's operational. In fact, I think I can give you the web address. I don't have it, I have it written down here, but it's too small for you to read. But it's something that you could play with right now. Let me just back up to some slides that I wanted to show about the GUI for controlling HPSS. Somehow they have gotten out of order as well. I'll be done in just a couple of minutes as soon as I find those slides. Here they are. I want to talk about storage classes and storage hierarchies, and to do that by just showing you what we have chosen at Caltech would be the simplest way. So back to HPSS GUI. You can monitor the health and the status of the system with the GUI. So this was a good day. Obviously, everything is green, normal for the devices, the volumes, the cartridges, the servers, time of day, the statistics of how many bytes have been moved since some point, how many bytes have been used, how many data transfers, 4,561, 84 current jobs. And this information is updated every 30 seconds in this particular case. Now, concept of storage classes, I'll read most of these since the letters are small. So we can set up a storage class, we call it the very imaginative name, two-way SSA disk. It's a storage class of type disk, and you use, for migration purge server, just a standard one called the same way. Migration policy name is disk migration policy. Purge policy name is disk purge policy. Media type is the default disk. And then you can give an estimated size of the physical volume, virtual volume, block size, stripe width, stripe length, media block size, segment, and so on. And then warning threshold and critical threshold for migration. Down here are other interesting things. Optimum access size, 64 megabytes, transfer rate of 20 megabytes a second. So the storage class is defined in these obvious ways. And then you can have some information that's useful for then deciding when you want to use it so that in the future you can do some optimal allocation of storage classes to particular transfers. Because if you don't have very large files, for example, then this storage class, which requires 64 megabytes for optimum transfer, would not be a good one for you. So that was a disk storage class. And then you can have tape storage classes. And so those are the characteristics, a different name for that one, and some are data. and then one defines storage hierarchies. All these examples are what we are using today at Caltech. So level one is the SSA disks dual copy, and level two is tape dual way, with the first copy being level two and the second copy being level three. And that's all we have defined at this point. For that one, that was storage hierarchy one, and storage hierarchy two is simply two-way SSA disk and two-way tape storage. So in the interest of time, since I'm between you and lunch, let me just end by summarizing as follows. Many trends, including the increase in computing speed, are leading to more and more data, created not just by instruments, but by simulation. Being able to store the data in the quantities that we need fast enough is quite a challenge. We have to do it in parallel. Being able to access it conveniently as well as fast enough requires, again, parallel data movement and a higher level interface. The HPSS system is one that we're using for the archival storage part, and so far, in our early experience, it seems to be flexible enough, modular enough, that we can use it in combination with the other tools to do some new applications. So stay tuned, and I hope that in a year or two, we'll be able to do the really large-scale projects with data that we will all like to do. Thank you.